This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
History tells the story of the world and of our lives. Sometimes that history goes bump in the night. Broadcasting from the center of oddity and the supernatural in Central Florida, it's the History Goes Bump podcast.
Hello, you spooktacular people. Welcome to this 535th episode of the History Ghost Bump podcast, Ghost Tours for the Theater of the Mind. I'm your host, Diane.
And this is Kelly.
Kelly, on this episode, we're heading down under to a location suggested to us by listener Julie Burton. And this is the Barama Courthouse. And while I was checking that out, I noticed that Barama has quite a few haunts there. So we're going to be talking about several haunts in this cute little village in Australia.
Awesome.
Before we get into that, we want to welcome into the Spooktacular crew, Alice, Travis, Nicole, Matt, Amelia spelling her name A-M-I-L-I-A, Virginia, Alex, Georgette, Lindsay, and Clint.
Thank you for joining the Spooktacular crew.
And now this moment in oddity.
In the fall of 1891, in Crawfordsville, Indiana, there was an unidentified specter that brought dread and horror upon the town. The incident took place in the wee hours of the morning on the 5th of September. Two men were preparing their ice delivery wagon when they witnessed something unexplainable to them. The creature appeared to be 18 feet long by 8 feet wide, moving through the air with several pairs of fins. It was white in color and had no distinct shape or form. They reported that there was a single flaming eye and that the creature made a plaintive wheezing sound. It is said that the men observed the entity for nearly an hour, hovering 300 to 400 feet in the sky before they left the area. Even a pastor and his wife reported observing the phenomenon. Shortly after the pastor's experience was shared, the Keeley Institute for Inebriates reached out to the pastor and his wife, suggesting that they visit and receive treatment. There were multiple newspaper articles regarding the encounters, with the Crawfordsville Journal, the Indianapolis Journal, and the Brooklyn Eagle reporting on the sightings. The local postmaster was deluged with letters, some of which stated that Judgment Day was near. Thankfully, two eyewitnesses tracked the beast and discovered it was actually a flock of several hundred killdeer birds. It was determined that due to the foggy conditions and newly installed electric city lights, the birds became disoriented, causing them to fly in a different manner than usual. However, there was also an alternative explanation for the apparition. This entailed a balloon parachute craze caused by boys in the city, some of which supposedly sent cats up in the balloons. Many of us in our podcast group were avid bird watchers, but a story that is still publicized today about a large spectral entity comprised of a flock of birds certainly is odd.
If you gaze long enough into an abyss, the abyss will gaze back into you. Friedrich Nietzsche.
And now, this month in history.
In the month of April, on the 11th in 1794, orator Edward Everett was born in Dorchester, Massachusetts. He was a gifted young man with an insatiable appetite for knowledge. Everett graduated Harvard University after 4 years of study at just 17 years of age. He then served as a pastor in Boston and from there continued pursuing academic goals. Everett received his PhD in Germany, becoming the first American to earn a German doctoral degree. Other career achievements included time spent as the president of Harvard, the governor of Massachusetts, He was elected a United States congressman and senator, as well as ambassador to Great Britain and secretary of state. So he really didn't do much.
Yeah, not at all.
One of his most memorable achievements, however, was personally raising more than $69,000 for the Mount Vernon Ladies Association to purchase Mount Vernon. His lectures spanned from March 1856 until spring of 1861 and raised a third of the monies needed for the purchase of what he spoke of as his Washington. Everett sent all the money earned from those audience-filled lecture halls to the Ladies Association without keeping anything to cover his own travel expenses. Although his lifetime achievements were great, he is best remembered as the man who lectured at Gettysburg for 2 hours, while Abraham Lincoln's speech was 2 minutes in length.
The Berrima Courthouse in the beautiful southern highlands of New South Wales in Australia is a great example of colonial architecture. The courthouse was a necessity as the colony was built on convicts and many continued their wayward deeds. The village of Berrima itself was an important stop on the path from Sydney to Victoria, and there were several hotels in the area. Many historic structures still remain, and spirits just may be inhabiting them, including the ghost of Australia's first serial killer. Join us as we explore the history and haunts of Berrima, Australia.
Berrima is a small historic village in the heart of the Southern Highlands. The Highlands sit 68 miles southwest of Sydney and features a luscious wine region. Berrima had once been the main town here and was initially meant to be the capital of the Southern Highlands. The Dharawal Aboriginal people had lived along the coastal area here for centuries as hunter, fisher, gatherers. European settlers arrived in the early 1800s. Two of these people were James Harper and his wife Mary. James had been the police chief constable at Sutton Forest, and he was the son of convicts. Mary herself was a convict. They bought a block of land in Berrima in 1832 and built the Surveyor General Inn in 1834 in the Georgian style. The inn remains today and is the oldest continuously licensed hotel in all of Australia. The name was a nod to Thomas Mitchell, who was the Surveyor General of the colony of New South Wales, from 1828 until his death in 1855. He was a larger-than-life character from Scotland.
Despite nearly 20 other licensed inns opening up in Berrima, the Surveyor General Inn did very well and clearly outlasted all of them despite a downturn in travel when the railway caused Berrima to be bypassed. Motor cars brought the tourists back in the 1930s. By the 1960s, the place was fairly neglected and run down and would have been demolished had it not been for residents making a push to get Parliament to pass a special act to preserve the inn and maintain its historic license. Restoration was difficult as the inn had been built from sandstone that was badly weathered. The current owners are the Durney family, and in 1997, they added an extension at the back of the inn to house a bistro. People claim that the inn is haunted. James Harper retired from the pub in 1839 and leased the business to recently widowed who owned a brewery at Goulburn and a general store in Berrima. She only hosted at the inn until 1840 when a Ralph Hush leased the place and he was replaced by William Taylor and his wife Mary in 1841. William had been a convict shipped to Australia after stealing sheep in 1832 and his wife Mary and daughter Lucy joined him in the following year. Mary died in 1842 and William remarried a woman named Bridget in 1844 and they would open the Crown Inn in 1844 which remains open in Berrima as Taylor's Crown Inn.
The ghost story featuring the Surveyor General Inn is connected to the Taylors. The Sydney Herald reported on June 13, 1842, a considerable sensation has been felt by the inhabitants of this town owing to the sudden death of Mrs. Taylor, landlady of the Surveyor General Inn. Mrs. Taylor was in apparent good health on the evening of the 7th and was observed passing to and fro underneath the veranda of the inn. However, about 2 a.m., Mr. Taylor was awakened by her restlessness and asked her, "What was the matter?" She replied, "Eh," and never spoke afterwards, having departed this life at 9 a.m.
Eh?
If you were up and pacing and I asked if you were okay and you just went, "Eh," I'd be like, okay. I mean, I was like, there's no other information.
You're so disrespectful. The woman died.
And then she's just dead the next morning. A little something more was going on here. Mr. and Mrs. Taylor had been married 30 years, and her sudden death has been doubly felt by him, being nearly inconsolable. It is to be hoped the sympathy and attention shown to him by his friends and acquaintances will so far succeed as to ameliorate his sorrows. I have no idea what that word is for this lamented but premature bereavement. The staff claims that Mary Taylor has returned to the Surveyor General in the afterlife. Her full-bodied apparition has been seen. They've had a lot of experiences around her with that. But I was like, wow, we need more details to the story. If only we could go back to 1842. Did he kill her? Was she feeling ill and that's why she was restless and then she just died? Or did she commit suicide? I mean, what happened? She just suddenly died?
One may never know.
After pacing for a while and telling her husband, I need more information.
In 1835, James Harper built Harper's Mansion, which still sits on a hill overlooking the town and features one of the largest hedge mazes in the country. This was designed in the Georgian style and built from bricks made on site. The exterior was 3 bricks thick and the interior was 2 bricks thick. More than likely, the workforce was the same as those building the Berrima Courthouse and jail at the same time. The Harpers had 6 children, with only 3 of them living into adulthood. One of the boys was only 2.5 years old when he walked into one of the immense fireplaces in the house.
I can't even.
I know. The other 2 more than likely passed from an illness like smallpox at the ages of 6 and 7. Harper owned much of the land in Berrima, and he died in 1845 heavily in debt. He had big hopes for Berrima, and while many blocks of land had been sold to speculators, not much had been developed. The house is said to be haunted.
Dodger 52 wrote on TripAdvisor, "The friend I was with had to quickly rush outside as she felt something strange that made her feel ill. Once outside, she was okay, but was not prepared to go back in. She said she's very sensitive to phenomenon. Apparently, 3 children had died in the house over 100 years ago, and 1 particularly gruesome death with a child dying when he fell into an open fire. So the place is very interesting and worth a visit during their open days. It's historic, over 135 years old, and well restored and looked after. And there are indeed reports of haunting activity at the mansion. A lady in white has made occasional appearances, and psychics claim that there are other spirits." So I don't know if, you know, all the children are haunting it, if this is their mother who's come back. But I will say that I did find an article in the Skeptical Inquirer where they did a scientific ghost study at the Harper's Mansion over a lengthy period of time. They had a couple of anomalies show up on their camera, which they just kind of wrote off as nothing and basically said this place is not haunted. So somebody's going to have to stay there and do some investigating and let us know.
Governor Burke visited Berrima in 1834, and he chose the site for the building of the courthouse. He laid the foundation stone in March of 1835, and sandstone was quarried from Church Hill. The roof was made from timber shingles, which was later replaced by slate. Immediate issues developed with the original architect and contractors, and so construction was stalled until Mortimer Lewis was appointed as the colonial architect. He designed the courthouse in the Regency style with 4 Doric columns along the front. The interior had decorative plasterwork cornices and cedar moldings, and the courtroom was topped by a vast greenhouse-type structure that allowed natural light to fill the interior. This was later replaced by skylights. The front entrance was bigger than it needed to be to inspire awe in all those who entered. Juror rooms were in both wings of the courthouse. There were also housekeeper's rooms, a dressing room for the staff, judge's retiring room or chambers, an office for the clerk of the court, and a witness room. Even with this new architect, issues continued and construction took until 1839 to be completed. Substandard workmanship left the roof leaking and water seeping into the foundation, and major repairs were needed over the next 20 years.
The courthouse opened with a salaried police magistrate and 9 police constables. It served as a court of assize from 1839 to 1846. Assize courts dealt with civil matters and criminal matters that were less serious. Although here in Berrima, murder cases were tried at the courthouse, because I wanted to know what an assize court was, so I looked it up. And then I was like, wait a minute, they had a serial killer here, and we're going to talk about some other killings. And I'm like, these are not less serious crimes. The first trial by jury in Australia took place here. This was also where all public administration was handled, like the licenses for taverns and people selling wares. Convicts also got their assignments here. Community events like dances and concerts were also held in the building, along with meetings. During World War I, German officers were kept in cells in the courthouse as prisoners of war. The School of the Arts used the building in the 1930s. They would be followed by other organizations until the courthouse was closed in 1972. The Department of Public Works restored the building after that and tried to bring it back to its original state, and that work was finished in 1976. The Berrima Courthouse opened as a museum that is owned by the New South Wales government and managed by a trust made up of local residents.
One of the most famous cases tried here was for Lucretia Dunkley and Martin Beach in 1843. The brutality of their crime shocked the entire colony. Lucretia had arrived in Australia as a convict who had been found guilty of serious crimes and sentenced to life in prison. She married Henry Dunkley in 1834, and the two had a farm near Gunning. In 1842, Henry hired paroled convict Martin Beach to work on the farm. Martin and Lucretia soon started an affair. In September of 1842, Henry went missing. Neighbors reported the behavior of Beach and Lucretia to the local magistrate, and they were arrested with a paper reporting that Dunkley's disappearance had turned out to be one of those deep-laid, preconcerted acts of human butchery, which occasionally take place to the disgrace of human nature.
Lucretia had confessed that Beach entered her and her husband's bedroom with a candle and axe and hit Henry in the forehead with the axe as he slept. Beach struck Henry two more times. The force was so great that it broke Henry's back. The two then put Henry's body in a sack and buried him in a hole and then cleaned the house. Despite the confession, the couple pled not guilty and were tried and found guilty and sentenced to hang. The judge said of Lucretia, "You, Lucretia, a name ill assorted with the adulteress and the murderer, exhibited on your trial a tone and manner accompanied by language which might well excite doubt of your kindred with the human species."
Oh my goodness.
You're not even human. And lead to the conviction that the devil himself had for a time assumed the female form. And I'm thinking, since it says her tone and manner accompanied by language, she must have been cursing a lot while she was sitting there. I'm not sure.
The pair were quickly executed. When Lucretia was hanged, her body ejected a fetus that she had apparently been impregnated with by Beach when the two shared a cell at the Berrima jail. Lucretia and Beach had their heads cut off after they were hanged, and their bodies were buried standing up so that they would never know any rest. Their skulls were sent off for scientific study in phrenology. 11 years after that, the skulls were donated to the Australian Museum, where they were put in boxes and still remain.
And I've seen them. There was a newspaper article about it, and they'd taken them out for it.
The fetal skull had also been with them, but is believed to have disintegrated. This story is told in the courthouse with an audio and light show and creepy-looking mannequins.
Kelly, this makes me think of the Salem Witch Museum that's kind of hokey with the mannequins and lights and sounds
sure.
And everything. I think it's probably very similar. I haven't seen it, but just based on the description and the pictures that I've seen, that's what I would guesstimate.
And now a little break for a word about one of our sponsors.
The old Berrima Jail was built in 1835 by a pardoned convict named James Goh and John Richards. Convicts in leg irons did the work under the watchful eyes of red-coated British garrisons. The jail had walls of stone 3 feet thick and 30 feet high and three wings that were 2 stories high. There was a central watchtower and 34 cells. This wasn't a place anyone wanted to be with harsh conditions. Cells were dark with solid cedar doors, and prisoners were confined to them nearly all day. All the light they got was whatever managed to make it under the door.
And wow.
An underground floor had 3 solitary confinement cells, and every prisoner had to spend time in them. So I think that was like when you first came in, boom, they just put you in solitary confinement for like a month and then put you in another cell. Eventually, a larger jail was built in another town, and this became a place for mainly older and sick prisoners. The jail closed in 1909 and then reopened in 1949 as the Berrima Training Center after extensive rebuilding. There's only a couple of pieces of the original jail that still are a part of it. During World War I, this was an internment camp for German prisoners. The jail was minimum security until 1970, when it was upgraded to medium security, and remained that way until 2001. In 2001, the name was changed to Berrima Correctional Center, and with that came a major change. For 166 years, it had just been a jail for men, and now this would be a women's jail. It closed again in 2011, but was reopened in 2016, finally closing for good in 2020.
Wow.
So this was originally built back in 1835, and didn't officially close till 2020.
That's crazy.
I don't think we've ever seen a jail with that kind of a time span.
There were two successful escape attempts from the jail. Bush Ranger Larry Elmans crawled 400 yards down a drain pipe to the river. At the end, he found a grate blocking his way and managed to break it out. The other escapee was named Mad Tom Cann of Carer. He had been sentenced to the jail after stealing a horse. He made it over the jail wall by making a hook out of a horseshoe and tying it to a homemade rope composed of strips of a chaff bag and throwing the hook up over the edge of the wall when the guard wasn't looking. Both men were recaptured.
And that chaff bag, I think, is a bag that horse eat out of. All the pictures I saw with it were that. So it seems to me like he was working somewhere where there was a horse and he used the stuff that he had there to make his stuff.
Sure.
Very ingenious making a hook out of that horseshoe. The courthouse features history tours and ghost tours because the place is reputedly haunted. The APPI has experienced a variety of activity while conducting tours. They've heard disembodied footsteps, had doors unlatch themselves and creak open, seen full-bodied apparitions, and even had doppelgangers.
Ooh.
There's also been piano music heard, and poltergeist activity moves objects around the property. During an investigation, APPI captured an EVP that said, "Free them all, cops." I'm going to go ahead and play that for you here multiple times. A police prosecutor was attacked in the male holding cell once when APPI was investigating. They have a video on their website, and it really looks like something got this guy. He had some very deep red marks on his neck. Perhaps the spirit knew he was a lawman and wasn't happy about it. Johnny commented, "I spent a lot of time at this location. Had footsteps walk right up to and past me. Another time, loud exhaling sounds. Also, a tapping sound that used codes to communicate, and it was always correct." So I don't know if it was like, you know, tap twice for yes, once for no.
They conducted a sensory deprivation experiment. A guest named Liz took part as she felt the air around her become very heavy and dense. And then towards the end, she ducked her head quickly. And she explained that even though she had headphones on, she thought she heard a loud bang. And then she felt like something was on top of her. She shook uncontrollably for about 5 minutes after the experiment. The group also conducted a table tipping session in a cell, and a guest named Helen started to feel her chair being tipped forward even though no one was behind her. And then she heard heavy breathing and felt very cold. Then she thought she heard someone say the name James or John, and it seemed angry. She herself felt overcome with anger and had to leave the cell. Another guest named Andrea had visited the courthouse many times, and she had the following experience. She was standing next to a basin in the judge's quarters, and she had her back to the door. The doorknob started rattling, and then the door opened, but everyone who was in the building was inside the room. So who opened the door? A short time later, the door to the vanity under the basin opened by itself.
There are thought to be several spirits here. One is referred to as Pale-Faced Patty Curran. Patrick Curran had been indicted for raping a woman named Mary Wilmore in 1841. Her husband had been away, and Curran accosted her when she went out for some wood, and he held a knife to her throat. The jury found him guilty. He was also indicted for being an accomplice to a Patrick Barry who shot a constable named Patrick McGuire. They both beat him, too. The jury deliberated for about a quarter of an hour and found Curran guilty of that crime as well. He was sentenced to death. He is seen flitting through the pine trees on dark nights, so he doesn't just haunt the courthouse, he's in the vicinity.
Another ghost is referred to as the abominable John Lynch, who is said to be the most callous murderer in Australia's history. And he was a horrible man. He would go from simple thievery to serial killer. Lynch was born in Ireland in 1812. When he was 19 years old, he was tried and convicted of obtaining goods under false pretenses in 1831. He was sent to the colony of New South Wales and arrived in October 1832. Lynch was assigned to work at the Oldbury Farm. And by 1836, he and another man named John Williamson were tried for the murder of another assigned servant on the farm named Thomas Smith. That man's body was found in the hollow of a fallen tree about a mile from the convict huts at the farm. There were two heavy pieces of wood nearby covered in blood and human hair. The case rested on a witness who wasn't found to be credible, and Lynch was found not guilty. Lynch later confessed that he did kill the man. He was put on a chain gang and later turns up in 1839, having reported being stabbed by three other convicts who were sentenced to death. those sentences were commuted to being sent to a penal settlement. It later came out that Lynch was bragging about how he got three men transported from the colony, but in actuality, he had stabbed himself to get revenge on them for something.
Well, that's who this character is up to this point.
Piece of work.
Lynch escaped and committed the Razorback murders, in which he killed a young indigenous boy and a man named Edmund Ireland with a tomahawk. He stole their stuff and headed towards Barima, where he committed the Fraser murders. This was a man and son, and Lynch again used the tomahawk and stole their stuff. In Barima, he hit the Mulligan farm and killed John Mulligan and his de facto wife, Bridget McNamara, and her two children. One of them was Mary, who was only 13, and Lynch violated her before murdering her. He then piled the bodies up and burned them and then squatted on the property for 6 months. He took on a different name and sent a letter out and said, yeah, they told me I could hang out here.
Good grief.
As papers related, the sickest thing about this guy was that, quote, he always prayed to the Almighty for aid before committing his killings.
Oh, my word.
So this is the kind of serial killer this guy is.
Good grief.
His final murder would be his undoing. He met a 27-year-old man named Kearns Landrigan along the road in February 1842. He asked the young man to come with him to Barima to do some fencing, and so they traveled together. So what he's done is basically told this guy, you want to do some fencing for me? Join me. I'll pay you this certain amount of money. And this guy's like, oh, yeah, great. They camped near the Ironstone Bridge about 7 miles from Barima. The morning of February 20th, Lynch hit Landrigan on the back of the head with the tomahawk twice. He dragged the body into the brush and decided to come back later to bury it. The next day, a laborer was passing by and found the body and reported it in Barima. A publican named John Chalker told the authorities that he had seen the dead man in the company of John Lynch, only it was under this pseudonym that he was apparently going with. The two had dinner at his establishment. He later went with the police to identify John Lynch. Lynch was arrested and indicted for Landrigan's murder. And then more people came forward, and before long, the authorities realized they had a multi-murderer on their hands. I didn't really call him a serial killer here because they didn't have that term back then. The Sydney Herald said of Lynch, "We doubt whether there ever existed in this colony a man so deep in crime as this man, and yet his appearance is not in the least such as would lead one to suppose he was a murderer." So what they're meaning here is Lynch was a good-looking guy, and he only stood 5'3" tall.
Oh my gosh, he's a pipsqueak.
Yeah, so you look at him and go, oh, this isn't a serial killer.
No offense to short-statured people.
Yeah, do I look like I'm a murderer?
You're a little pipsqueak.
I am a little pipsqueak. No, I'm fun size.
That's right.
Lynch was tried in the Barima courthouse on March 21st, 1842, and found guilty of Landrigan's murder. He was sentenced to hang. Lynch had killed at least 10 people, so this was justice for all of them. Before the trap door swung down, ending Lynch's life, he did a little step dance for the crowd. So his spirit's been seen around, hanging in the streets and all that other stuff.
A third spirit is said to be Lucretia Dunkley, and she appears as a headless apparition. Martin Beach's spirit is here as well, missing his head too. Paranormal investigator Judy Kim and psychic June Cleland are part of Southern Highlands ghost hunts and investigations. Kim told the Sydney Morning Herald, "You can never guarantee paranormal activity is going to happen, but I've never had it not happen in here. We've heard doors slamming, voices, and you'll probably feel the presence as you go in." She pointed to the jail next door and said, "People were hanged just over there, and the bodies were buried standing up just inside that wall, so you never know who's going to be hanging around." Cleland definitely feels like Lucretia is haunting the courthouse. She told the paper, "This is one of the most haunted places I've been in. Some of them, like Lucretia, are not really aware most of the time. She's lost in her own anger, bitterness, and resentment. But there are others that will stand giggling, watching you, and they want to do things, make noises. Others are sort of passing through."
Sounds like there's some ghosts that like to pull pranks in there.
Like me.
So the jail closed in 2020, but it hasn't been open to the public. It's some developers bought it, and who knows what they're going to do with it.
Oh.
So there's been no investigations in there. So there's probably some haunts going in there as well. But we just don't know because it hasn't been investigated. So all of this stuff has been going on in the courthouse. And please excuse Kiwi, who is screaming in the background.
He has a lot to say about everything.
Barima has a long history in Australia, and many firsts for the colony happened in this little village. Are there spirits of killers walking the streets and hanging out in the buildings? Are these locations in Barima haunted?
That is for you to decide.
Well, cool. We would love to hear from those of you who live in Australia if you've stayed at any of the locations there in Berrima.
Absolutely.
Looks like some really cool places. We'd love to have you guys check out our website at historygoesbump.com. And if you'd like to send us some feedback, you can do that at historygoesbump@gmail.com. We did have Callie post this in the crew. They know how to send little signs. I'm sorry for the longer post. It's so amazing to get a little sign from a loved one that's passed, whether they are human or four-legged. My post is about a four-legged loved one. 6 years ago, when my husband and I moved into our own house, we brought my favorite barn cat, who was 4 years at the time, into our house. We fought and fought with him for about 2 years to strictly just be a house cat. Finally, I caved, and since we moved next door to my parents, felt comfortable enough to let him be an indoor-outdoor cat. I bought a collar with a nice name tag before we let him make this transition, and wouldn't you know it, he lost it after 3 days. Big surprise. I was so frustrated that he lost the collar so fast, mainly because of the name tag. We got him a couple other collars over the years, but never another name tag. We lost my special boy last fall to cancer. I was totally devastated. He was definitely one of the best cats with a huge personality. Today, while we were gathered with family in the yard watching the eclipse, my dad looked at me and said, "Hey, Jack's collar's on the dirt pile." Confused how he knew it was his because our current indoor-outdoor cat has lost a few collars, I asked him what he was talking about. He repeated, "Jack's collar is on the dirt pile, the one by the woodshed." After family left, I told my husband I was going to get the collar my dad was talking about. After doing so, I came back with tears in my eyes. My husband asked what was wrong. All I could do was hold up that first collar with the name tag he had lost all those years ago. After a few minutes, I called my dad and asked where in the dirt pile it was, to which he replied, "Right on top for someone to find." This dirt pile has been in the same spot for probably 10 years. It's walked past several times a day. I told my husband what my dad said and told him it was my little sign. He asked how I knew, and I told him because I was talking about him and how much I miss him with a friend at work today. I cleaned his collar up, and it now hangs on our mantle. I'm also sharing a picture of Jack's collar and our special boy. This goes to show they do hear us and know how to send us little signs.
I love that. So special.
How else do you explain a collar that he lost years and years and years ago ending up on the top of a dirt pile? It's just not even a possibility to be on top of a dirt pile. I don't even know how you would find something after he'd lost it years and years and years ago. But the fact that she was like, "Hey, you know, I lost Jack and been missing him," talking to her coworker. And then she goes home and he's like, "Hey, Mom, I heard you talking about me." Just very cool. I love those pet ones for sure. I want to thank you guys for tuning into this episode. I've been your host, Diane.
And this has been Kelly.
You take care now.
Bye-bye.
This episode is brought to you by our executive producers.
Make Mort a happy boy and share the podcast.
Spectacular people, welcome. We do so many we do so many different types of episodes now. It's like, which one are we doing? Is it a redux? It is a paranormal conversation, phantasmal crime.
Maybe Mort will help you out.
There's no helping her.
He then served as a pastor in Boston and from there continued Everett received his PhD in Germany, becoming the first American to earn a
germ. It's a germeral.
It's a germeral doctoral degree. What's a germeral? It means he's an expert in germs.
Okay. Is he like Monk?
Yes.
And washed his hands a lot. A lot.
Yeah.
By the 1960s, the place was fairly neglected. It got stuck in my mouth. That man's body was found in the hollow of
Okay. Is that new language we've created?
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.